Okay, so I'd like to start by covering something that I kind of glossed over when we covered reorder buffers and when I viewed them last time. And that's what entries in a reorder buffer are valid. And the strategy that is typically used in that the reorder buffer here we talked about is we have a head pointer and a tail pointer. So these are just numbers saying an index of a reorder buffer entry. And when we're doing this process of processing reorder buffer entry in the commit phase to, for example, add to the free list, or for this to adjust the register map when going backwards towards an exception, in either case, we need to change these pointers to conceptually remove an entry from the reorder buffer. The reorder buffer is a physical fixed size thing, so we can't actually remove an entry, but we can set our pointers up so we're going to know that that entry isn't used. And also so we know which entry to replace next when we actually have something to write. So I just wanted to make that clear. So that's what's going on when we're processing entries as far as how they get out of the reorder buffer. So any questions about this? Okay, so before I move on to reviewing a couple things that were other highly requested topics, which will be vector instructions, relaxed memory models, the TLB and caches, how they interact, and out of order trade-offs and VLIW, depending on how much time we have, are there any specific questions, requests, things people want to ask, rather than me going through some mostly canned review? Yeah?
Just kind of for like studying strategies in general for the way that the material is laid out, because I know that, you know, reading was a lot focused on paper.
Yeah.
And then in class, some of the concepts were presented that were also mentioned in the paper, so they're kind of like, they fit together. Based on the format of the final, is it better to like read the abstracts of the papers again and then cross-check that against like what you had in your slides for what the paper was about, or to like reread the actual presentations of a lot of the papers that are posted on the internet, like people's, like the actual PowerPoints that were given by the researchers? Or just to like read the book on those topics?
So for topics which our book has good coverage, which is not all the papers, reading the book is probably pretty fine.
Okay.
So for time reasons, I'm asking mostly conceptual questions on the exam. I've looked at what my draft is and, well, I mean, I have a copy here. There's lots of like multiple choice conceptual questions, that sort of thing, where what you need to know is like, what was the high level idea of what the paper was doing and what's good and bad about that? You know, when does that work well, when doesn't it work well? What constraints does it impose? And not all of that comes out in the abstract. Like, the abstract of the paper on VLIW isn't gonna tell you that. Isn't gonna tell you when VLIW is good. The abstract of the paper on out of order isn't going to tell you the sorts of things we explored in homework too. So you need a little more detail than that, but it's high level concepts, like we're not gonna, so it's like, what is the idea of this technique and when does it work well or not well?
Okay.
And not like, what are the specific implementation details for the most part? Because we rarely went into them. The only case where we went into like lots of like, how does everything work at each step? Details were like cache coherency, where we gave you a description such that you probably should be able to tell me what every message in a protocol is and what every state is, and for caches themselves, where you probably should be able to tell me what every bit we need to store in a cache is, because we had that level of detail. But for things like out of order, yes, we had a paper which talked about how to all the bits in an out-of-order processor, but we didn't discuss it in the same level of detail that, you know, I'm not going to ask you, name everything that's in the reorder buffer. Yeah.
Like every bit associated with it.
Yeah, like that's not a sort of thing I would expect you to know for out of order structures, though you should know it for caches. Like, you should be able to reason about what should be in there in the reorder buffer, but I'm not gonna expect you to do that sort of detailed level of coming up with something without an appropriate prompt for where you should be able to figure out, oh, I need to have this because I know reorder buffers are used to do this part of committing an instruction. Like, but, yeah.
Is branching information stored in the reorder buffer?
Branch what?
Like branch prediction information stored there, so you know where to go back in case you're executing the program.
So for this varies. So, like, if the MIPSR 10,000 paper did special things for branch prediction, and it had, so you don't need to store anything extra though. You should observe. So all you need to know is what the branch instruction is, and presumably you compute the actual target address. And that's not computed in the reorder buffer because the reorder buffer is set before we know what that is. And once you know the actual target address, to roll back, everything you need is in the reorder buffer. So some processors might do something extra just to be faster, but as far as correctness is concerned, this was a branch, I believe, here, we could roll back to instruction F. And we know what the next instruction to fetch is because we got the outcome of the branch, and that's all we need is the registers at the time of instruction F and what to fetch next. So we don't need to add anything special to the reorder buffer besides the ability to indicate that there's something like an exception. Other specific questions, inquiries, things people would like me to review in particular? Well, let me know if you think of them as we go over other topics. Okay, so let's start with vector instructions. This was my only request for confusion. And the key idea of vector machines is that we have this abstraction where we give you an instruction which, you know, has some syntax like one of these two in assembly commonly, where we have some mask and we have these vector registers. So we actually have multiple elements in a register, and we do operations in all of them. So this is the big abstraction we get, and the reason this is faster is because we've eliminated a whole lot of control logic for doing the same amount of math. So we talked about chaining, where we had consecutive instructions like this, and we move forwarded elements between them. That wasn't something that we couldn't do with the out-of-order design or with a simple pipeline processor if we had a separate instruction for each add, but we've eliminated all the complexity of tracking the state of all the extra instruction we'd have to fetch, and also fetching all those instructions. So these vector processors are more efficient as far as how they're using their actual chip space. And so our key idea is we have these instructions which operate element by element with some exceptions. And we had two ways we did that. We had this predicate mask register. So conceptually what an instruction execution does is it iterates over all the vector elements and only uses ones where if there's a mask register specified, the corresponding entry is true. So the mask register is a bit mask saying which elements of the vector are currently active. And sometimes it's implicit, so like on GPUs, they have an implicit mask that's used in their divergence scheme to say what the GPU calls threads are actually active. And the other thing we saw was a vector length register. So if you want to support variable length vectors, we'll just have a maximum length you can set, and this makes it convenient to compile code for a vector machine which deals with arbitrarily sized arrays. You don't have to worry about making everything for the Cray-1 a multiple of 64. There's a mechanism to make that relatively convenient to do, where you can set this vector length register for the special case where you're not dealing with 64 things, and the machine will do something efficient. So any questions about this? So as a little exercise, here's some code. So write this machine as a vector program. So write some pseudo-assembly, the syntax similar to the ones in the previous slide, for a machine with 64 element vectors. And assume it either has a vector length register and or mask registers. You choose which ones it has. And you need and convert this to a vector program, and it needs to work for any length. And it should actually use vector instructions. Like, all these vector machines generally have scalar instructions. But obviously, we're not winning if we do this as a scalar loop. You would not be happy with a GPU compiler, which took this loop and turned it into scalar. It's only scalar operations. So this is what I think is the easy part of converting this to vector code, which is that this is the basic inner loop that we load part of x, the big array x, and we increment it and we store it back. The tricky part is that this doesn't deal with the case where length is not 64. Or not a multiple of 64, but this handles multiples of 64 parts. And in particular, after we do this, the next step is to set R1 to R1 plus 64 times size of int. And this is our main loop. So the challenge here is that this doesn't deal with what's left over. So what's a way we could deal with what's left over? Yes?
You could just do this for only the length of the array, y by 64, floor of that number of times.
Okay.
Get the difference, make a mask of the difference, and do that one time afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your strategy is that, so we're going to have a loop here where we're going to keep track of a counter, and as long as we're less than, so the pseudocode, well, we can convert this to actual branching, is while some our count plus 64 is less than length, just our count. We'll increment our count by 64. This will keep us from dividing ever, which is, if you're a compiler, something you will spend effort doing. As a human, you might not care. Or maybe, I guess dividing by 64 is shifting, so that's not so bad. So that's one thing. And then you have to deal with the rest. And so your idea is you want to get a mask. So how would we construct a mask that's appropriate?
A 64-bit length mask.
Yeah.
With the first remaining count, I guess, length minus the current R count.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then we need to set, so you can figure out the bit fiddling to do that. So it's basically first, so it's one, this happens to be 1 over len minus r count minus 1. That happens to be that bit mask. So we can set mask is equal to this, and then do everything with at mask. That would be one way of doing it. So any questions about this solution? The solution we have here is first we do everything for the multiples of 64 at the beginning with a loop. And when we have our last chunk that isn't a multiple of 64, we set this mask. So it's a number of ones equal on the mask equal to the number of elements we have left over. And then we use that mask for every single vector instruction here, so we don't process the extra elements, because that would be accessing out of bounds of the array, not what the C code does. So that's the valid solution. It turns out that there's a solution that fits comfortably on one slide if you use vector length registers, which is a little easier. So we first set the vector length register to 64 mod, the actual length on 64, and then we set it to 64 for every other iteration of the loop. Yeah?
So there's a system call that will expand a region of memory you've already allocated if possible?
Yes.
Or find memory of the size you want and copy everything over. How often would it then be efficient to just pad the array?
So, no. So if you remember our vector machines like the Cray, the way they did, so we have this notion from GPUs that the typical case for a vector machine is that if we have a 64 element vector, that means that we have you know, we have 64 ALUs, but that is not how all vector machines work. Sometimes it will be like, not x64u, it will be like x16. In which case, to do 64 operations with 16 ALUs, to dispatch them, is going to take at least 4 cycles. And if you have a smaller length, it will take less time. Or if you have more things masked out. So on many of these vector machines, especially the original ones and more modern incarnations of them, you know, they don't actually have the capability of doing 64 operations at once. Because remember, the big reason we want vector processors is because it simplifies the control logic, not necessarily because we're going to have that much computation available. So setting the length lower is going to still make our program faster, and it's going to be efficiently supported by the machine. And obviously, we could also compile this so we have two versions of the loop, so we don't execute this vector length equals 64 instruction every time, which I didn't do, so just because I wanted it to fit on one slot. So other questions, comments? Vector machines. So how vector instructions work. So the big thing to remember is that these two big mechanisms, having these masks and having this vector length register, are the ways that we go from these vector instructions being something that are pretty hard to use without a lot of work to something that, you know, it's relatively easy to convert a loop to use. Not super easy, because I don't think all of you felt that exercise of dealing with the rest of the vector was something that you would be happy picking up a processor manual and writing assembly for, but something that we can consistently implement in compilers, which is very important if you want your vector machine to actually be used. Okay. So that's my brief review of vector machines, and we'll go back to this if people have come up with questions later. So I'm going roughly in order by number of 4 + 5 responses on the survey here, with weighting towards 5 responses. So the next big question people had was about relaxed memory models. We wanted to review that. And I think the most important thing to understand about relaxed memory models, you know, I think the concept that processors are going to do things other than the order you request is straightforward enough, and that sometimes it's important enough to maintain the order. But the big question is, what are they gaining? The big thing to think about is, what is the processor gaining by reordering instructions? So can people come up with some reasons why a CPU would want to be able to do memory operations in the wrong order?
Well, it kind of boils down to like throughput. Mm-hmm. Instructions you want to put through, you know, execute as many as possible in a given amount of time. So you just kind of mix everything up and try and do as much computation as you can in the shortest amount of time.
Yeah, so one of the reasons is that we wanted to execute instructions as soon as they're ready. This is the whole idea of out-of-order processors. And sometimes we have multiple loads and multiple stores in a program, and some of the loads and some of the stores will be ready earlier, and we want to actually be able to take advantage of that. So that's one and probably the most important reason why processors really want to not have to guarantee, you know, strict memory orderings for efficiency. So are there other advantages besides when we can execute instructions? Yeah. Okay, so there's stuff we have to add to the hardware to guarantee memory order. So even with and some of the stuff we usually don't get rid of, but is extra hardware. So for example, even on a single thread, we need to make sure that if we have a store followed by a load of the same address, we need hardware to detect those conflicts. when we need to worry about other processors, we need extra hardware to keep track of what, you know, the appropriate cache entry and make sure that it's still around when we actually need it. So we have this extra hardware complexity to do the same work. So any other things people can think of? So there's some optimizations which are not really just executing, not really about executing instructions at different times that we talked about, which can break memory ordering. So I have three listed here. And one of them is from the cache coherency protocol. So there's some issue with cache coherency protocols where we might break memory ordering, want to break memory ordering. And there's some issues with an optimization that out of order processors often use that would break memory ordering. In an optimization they would use in addition to executing instructions when they're ready. So in the cache coherency protocol, how do we actually guarantee coherency? What do we need to do to make sure to write a value and know that, you know, we're doing it in a consistent order? Yeah, and what do we tell them to do?
Either give us the value or invalidate.
So we either tell them to give us the value or invalidate. And that's how we enforce that things happen in a particular order. And one of the things that is tempting to do is to just invalidate a value and not wait for everyone to say, yes, I invalidated that value if I had it. And this was one reason why if we took this choice, we would break memory orders. Because there would be cases where one processor could notice that an value was invalidated earlier than another one's. Could read it while we were waiting for that to happen and still conceptually made a change too early. So there are some cases where this would cause a problem, which is a pretty subtle problem, but this is annoying for cache coherency protocols because that means we actually need to wait. This was often called write atomicity in some of the papers we talked about, that the write appears to happen at different times in different places because we aren't waiting until it's all complete before we move on to the next write. So in complex situations, you could observe that we weren't waiting for everyone to finish invalidating X before we wrote Y. So the other two optimizations I was thinking about were load and store forward. And these are things where we replace a load, two consecutive loads of the same value, with one load. Or where we replace a load of a value we just stored with the value we just stored. And these are very tempting optimizations for an out-of-order processor because they're 100% correct with a single thread. And they save a whole cache access. We never even talk to the cache, which is great, but unfortunately they can break memory orders. They're also actually pretty common in real programs. It's pretty easy to write programs where, like, if you spill stuff to the stack, where usually there's no memory ordering problems, like, these will often be useful for accessing those values that are spilled to the stack, or other temporary values that don't when you run out of registers. So any questions about these sorts of reasons? Yeah, and there's one that I didn't mention here, I shouldn't have brought up, which is that you know, even if we could maintain consistency, it increases the hardware complexity because maintaining consistency often means that, you know, we need to add checks before we let instructions commit, or add comparisons of addresses to make sure they are no conflict. We can get rid of those if we don't care about memory order as much. Okay, so as an exercise here, so here's a bunch of code. Let's say x and y are initially zero, and we run this. So come up with, so exercise here, come up with two examples. There are 8 in total, but I'm not expecting you to enumerate all of them because the way I figured it out is by writing a program. And it was very tedious, but come up with two examples of sequential or sequentially consistent orders. And come up with an example of a non-sequentially consistent order and, you know, give me an argument for why that could happen. And when you, yes. And ideally compare your answer with a neighbor when you're done to make sure you both believe. That your sequentially consistent orders are and your non-sequentially consistent order is not. I said giving the orders, examples of the results for a particular, so the values of R1, 2, and 3. I have a different example on this slide than the next one. Not MO. Not in the material way. So there probably aren't 8 orders. 8 different outcomes for that reason. Because that would make sense. So there aren't 8. But yeah, come up with an example of inconsistent order. So, who has a non-consistent order? Or they think is impossible with sequential, sorry, a result they think is impossible with sequential consistency, but might happen on some processor. So, one person? Yeah. Yes, and I meant to add, yeah. Replace this example with another, but we'll go through this example on the board instead of with slides then. Okay, now who thinks they have a non-consistent result? That's only a few people. Who thinks they have two consistent results? Two outcomes from a sequentially consistent execution that have different values? Same group of people. So what is for sequentially consistent outcomes, the model is that we just choose one of the two threads, the two CPUs code, to run each step. So one thing we can do is we can, so we can say we run ry is 1, then we choose, say we could choose something from CPU 2 or CPU 1 again. It's our choice. So let's say we just swap every time. It's 2, R2 equals Y. And this will give us R1 equals 0, R2 is 2, and R3 is 0. So that's one possible outcome from a sequentially consistent execution. And I know it's sequentially consistent because I just interleave the instructions in order to get that result. I didn't need to do anything else to explain what happened. It's as if we took one instruction from each CPU at a time and ran it to completion. So, and I can get other orders by just interleaving it in a different way. So one way I could interleave is by just taking, say, from CPU 2 until I run out of stuff to take, and then take from CPU 1. It's also taking one instruction at a time from what's available. I'm just doing it in a more biased way. So I take R3x, y gets 2, then R1 becomes y, x becomes 1, R2 becomes y, and this gives us R1 equals 2, R2 equals 2, R3 equals 0. That's another possible result. So I think there's just one inconsistent result that seems likely. There's some unlikely one. There's some ones which would seem very implausible. That could also happen, but one result which we could imagine happening that is not sequentially consistent is R1 becomes 2, R2 becomes 2, and R3 becomes 1. So the reason this doesn't seem sequentially consistent is that for R2 to become 1, that means the assignment on CPU 2 had to execute. But it's supposed to be after the assignment to R3, so we couldn't have set X to 1 yet. Does this make any questions? Does this make sense? Is this key concept here? So that something happened out of order. So one possible way for this to happen is for that store to happen early. If we decide to execute that store early because CPU 1 notices, oh, X and Y are different addresses, it doesn't matter when I do those two things. If the CPU 1 makes that choice, then CPU 2 will and CPU 1 will observe this impossible result. That there's no possible ordering that explains what happened. So that's a simple thing which could have happened there. So there are other results which are also not sequentially consistent, but much less plausible. So for example, we could imagine like R1 is 2, R2 is 0, and R3 is 1, or is 0, let's say. That seems impossible because somehow the assignment to Y happened and then unhappened. And some memory models make this technically plausible, but we can't really think of a reason why this might happen with the systems we know about. If this is what's going on. But this is another non-sequentially consistent ordering, it's just one which is harder to explain why it would happen. So any questions about these? And when making these slides, I made my example bigger and didn't change the slide. So I have an alternate example where I've added one assignment here and one assignment here. Because that will illustrate some other examples of non-consistent orders. So in particular here, this is, as I said, I've just added an assignment to X assignment reading from X on CPU 1 and assignment writing to X on CPU 2. And this is to illustrate how store and load forwarding can break consistency. So here, we could get a result where R2 is 2, meaning that this assignment to Y happened. And R3 is 1, meaning that this assignment to X, which was before that, looks like it didn't happen yet, or happened last. And an easy way to explain this is that maybe CPU 1 does store forwarding. That the out-of-order processor said, oh, I write to X and read it? Why would I bother accessing the cache? But in this case, we have inconsistency because of that. I think that's it. But we could have, so this is an example, these are situations where that would be right to happen. So, just to keep in mind that these optimizations break that. I'm not sure whether this example is actually right after looking at it more, but there is an example, cases where you could have four load store forwarding here that would break things clearly. And that's something to keep in mind. I will try to 2 weeks, two. That ran. So R2 equals 2, and I think this should be R4 equals 1. And R4, and R3 equals 1, and R4 equals 2 equals 1. That's what I mean. I'm missing the end R4 equals 1 here. So if R4 is 1, that means this assignment executed, then this executed, and this executed in between there. That's what I'm missing, sorry. I will correct this slide before I post it. So, but the idea here is that if we have, if we can prove from what happened that we squeezed everything in CPU2 in here, then the store forwarding is wrong, and that could happen. Okay. So any other questions on relaxed memory models? Okay, so let's go on. The next topic in our grand tour is transactional memory. So we talked about this briefly, and I think these are the key things I'd like you to know about it. So what's a transaction? Any ideas? Like, what does it mean for something to be a transaction? Someone over here? No? Okay. Yeah?
It's just a set of memory operations that have to be committed in order atomically.
So it's not in order, but they're committed atomically. So it's as if they happen all at once or they don't happen. So it's that idea that it's as if they're uninterrupted by any other sets of memory operations. So that's the illusion we're trying to maintain. Even though we have multiple memory locations and it's not possible to actually write them simultaneously in the physical world. So transactional memory is a very powerful idea, but it had some real limitations in its hardware implementation. So what were some examples of things that transactional memory couldn't handle well?
I think one example was communicating to things on other networks. So it's based on being able to undo an operation.
Yes.
Once you've said it's gone.
Yeah, so transactional memory assumes that everything is local. So if you're doing any sort of I/O, then you can't undo that. So that's something we can't handle. There's another big limitation of transactional memory, which is that we need to store this transaction log. We need to have a record of everything which happened. And we use something like a cache for that, but that has limited space. And if you ran out of space for hardware transactional memory, the story was, we can't do it. And the papers propose various ways of switching over to software mechanisms, but that's not so great. Certainly not so efficient. So other question is, what makes transactional memory performance good or bad? So what's an example of a case where the performance would be very good or very bad? What are factors we were concerned about?
The size of the transaction means a lot. So if it's huge, then there's like a huge chance for interruption. So you kind of have like a...
Yeah. So the big thing to think about is that transaction aborts are a big cost. So in a transaction, unlike with locking, when we start a transaction, we don't know that we're going to be able to finish it, but we're going to do work anyways. So we're in trouble if we're often doing work that doesn't actually commit. There's also costs potentially related to the size of the transaction log with respect to how much the hardware has to do to manage the transaction. It's like on committing a transaction, it needs to change a bunch of entries in the hardware structure. That wouldn't happen with a lock where we have only one thing we're manipulating. So I think those are, so that's one of the big things. So I had completely different factors here. So one factor we mentioned is live lock. So transactions don't guarantee that when you abort and retry, that it will work again, because you could have the same thing happen over and over again. And we have to do various things to make sure that didn't happen. So if you have high contention, you might run into cases where you spend a lot of time aborting a transaction that caused another transaction to abort, and so on. Where you have a lot more laced work than would even be possible versus the amount of waiting you'd have to do with locks. Also, with contention, it can be worse than locks because, like, a short transaction could cause a long one to abort. So we'd have much more wasted work than if we actually waited in line. And another issue is that we had these types of locks where we could give things some idea about how fair things were, where we could give guarantees about latency, and the mechanisms we know about for transactions don't give us that. They don't really say, they say who wins, but they don't let us guarantee that people wait in line easily. So questions, comments about transactions, questions? Yeah.
Are there particular technical reasons why it's so common
for databases? So database transactions aren't implemented like hardware transactions, is one thing. It's a convenient abstraction, which is why the hardware people find it so attractive. But database transactions, I guess, if you look at the right way, you might say it's implemented like hardware transactions, but they have their own flavor of techniques. In particular, they often involve copying data a lot more than hardware transactions do. But it's a useful abstraction because it's really easy to reason about. Right. With locks, locks are easy to reason about, but as far as where do I add locks to my program to make it correct but efficient, that is not an easy problem for people to solve. Like, it's easy to add a lock to make it correct, you just lock before doing anything. That's not efficient. But with transactions, you can pretty much just put a transaction around anything which might communicate, and it's correct and, for many, many programs, reasonably efficient. And certainly for database operations, reasonably efficient. So it's just much easier to reason about than locks, and also much easier to reason about correctness, because the correctness criteria for transactions is just, can I order these transactions in a way which causes a wrong result? The correctness criteria for locks is a lot more complicated to think about. You need to say, these things could happen in any order. Do I have the right locks to ensure things? You don't have to just say, could I put the transactions in any order? And for databases, we've talked about a way of implementing transactions, but don't assume that's how databases work, because there's a bunch of techniques databases can use. And not all of them are something we could easily do in hardware. Other questions, comments? Okay, so this is a brief coverage of transaction memory, mainly because we spent only one day on it. So it's probably less likely I'd ask you to like write, well, also for length reasons that I like ask you to like detail the states of a transactional memory system and all that. But I want you to know what it's good for and basically how it works, that it's about the cache coherency protocol, taking advantage of that information. So another topic people wanted to know about was the interaction of TLBs and caches, where they intersect. And the important concept here is that we have this case where if we had pick a virtual address, it's possible that, you know, that we're going to need to store, and we want to use that with the cache. So ideally, you just take these virtual addresses here and send them right to the cache and be done. So you can have virtual indexes or not in the cache, and virtual tags in the cache. Just use virtual addresses for the cache. That would be much faster because we'd avoid this TLB lookup or page table lookup before every access. And you know, that sometimes slows our programs down. It certainly makes the path through the processor longer, so it definitely increases latency if we have to do that all the time. So one solution, and the solution that was in the Smith paper, one of the very common solutions, is that we disallow overlap between the page number and the set index. This doesn't mean the cache doesn't deal with physical addresses, but it means we can delay the use of physical addresses. So this is from the figure from the Smith paper. We take our set number, what they call a line number, look up something in the cache, and after we do that lookup, only then do we need the physical address. We need the physical address because we're still storing the physical address in the cache. But we can look up the physical address while we're looking up the data and that thing we're comparing to the physical address later. And this is a very commonly used technique, but it imposes some restrictions. In particular, our address actually needs to be laid out without this overlap. We need to not have overlap in order for that to work, so we can actually divide up the address this way. So we don't have something which is both page number and line number, or something that's both, some part of the, both page number and line number. Yeah, you don't have something that's both page number and line number. So that imposes a restriction on the organization of our cache. But this is a common technique because, usually this first step takes a while, and so does this TLB lookup. And you can make the TLB small enough, so in the good case, this is entirely overlapped. So questions about this technique? This is the most common technique. And so that means that we're basically, we split the address up. So we have, you just don't have any overlap. We either have the set index right up against the page number, or we have the set index somewhere in the middle and some part which is used for the tag and the page number. And in this case, we're storing physical, real addresses in the tags. So another option is we can not restrict the organization of our cache and just say, I'm going to use the TLB first, that I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to cut this off and put the real address through to here, meaning I'm going to make every cache access wait for a TLB access to finish first. And this is a real option that real processors can use sometimes, but it's not so great. But it doesn't change the throughput, it just changes the latency, so maybe it's not so bad. So there's a third option, which is what is known as virtual caches, where we store virtual addresses in the cache. And this is including in storing virtual tags. So everything in the cache is a virtual address. And this is attractive because there's no translation for most instructions. So unless we have a cache miss, which is already going to be slow, we never use a TLB. So it exists, but But it's complicated because we have this aliasing problem. That we might have two virtual addresses, which are the same physical address. And we need to deal with that and still get the same results. So there are real systems which do this, and there's different ways that they have of managing this problem. So one is to tell the operating system, you better not do aliasing, or else weird things will happen. Just tell the operating system it's your problem to not do this. And it's your problem to prevent aliasing, also to tell the cache when you update a page table entry. Because that's updating a page table entry will change whether something in the cache is right, which doesn't happen with the other design of cache, because the physical tag doesn't change. So even if something's in the cache which isn't accessible, we'll fail our TLB lookup, and we won't access it accidentally. Another technique which some people have proposed is that you could have like an L2 with physical tags, which also has a copy of the virtual address that the L1 is supposed to have if it has a copy of it, and fix it up that way. So you can use some other table. But we have this extra complication somewhere to deal with this aliasing problem, and also to deal with what happens when we change the page table. So that was our three options. So we have our disallow overlap is the most common option, which means we just need to change how the cache organization, so we have the right number of bits to use to look up the set, or translating first. And then we have that third option of virtual caches, which are faster but create complications elsewhere to deal with aliasing and changing the page table. So questions about this? Okay. So, and our third of marathon topics was about trade-offs in out-of-order processors. How do we think about that? And this was a lot of what the questions in homework 2 were about, which there was mixed performance on. And you know, one thing to think about is you should know like roughly what a out-of-order processor looks like. It looks something like this. We have this in-order part and this in-order part at the end. At either end, we have this out-of-order part, which has a bunch of queues in the middle. And we have a bunch of data structures. We have an instruction queue, a reorder buffer, and a physical register file. So a physical register file stores values we're computing on. The instruction queue is our pending to execute instruction, and the reorder buffers are pending to commit instructions. And we had a bunch of sort of conceptual trade-offs with respect to reordering computation. And the biggest one is that no matter how much parallelism we tried to get, dependencies plus latencies were eventually a limit on performance. Which meant that as we added more and more resources to the processor of any kind, that we get diminishing returns because we were getting closer to this point where our dependencies plus, you know, that instruction X needs R1 to be computed by instruction Y and so on. And how long it takes to do each step of the computation actually limits our performance. And this is particularly bad because we have some types of latencies which can be especially long. So one example is cache and memory accesses. So if we have slow cache and memory accesses, it doesn't really matter what the rest of our program is doing often. Like how long we have to wait for that cache access will be our performance. And similar might be true for branchless resolution. If you have a branch where we can't figure out whether it's taken sooner or later, and we guessed wrong with branch prediction, then that's going to be a big cost. Because that's the dependency in every single instruction. So it's not so much the length of latency, but how many instructions that latency affects. That we can't really hide it, so it appears long. And the only way we can get rid of this dependency problem in a processor is that we have speculation, which lets us cheat on dependencies. So one example of speculation is branch prediction. With branch prediction, we guess what a branch will do, and that lets us cheat on actually figuring out the dependencies. And when our cheating works, we save a lot of time. Another example of speculation we've seen is memory reordering. That we have processors which try to do loads earlier than they're supposed to, and figure out later whether there was actually a conflict. So like the MIPS R10000, not only did it do loads out, it did loads out of order, but it gave sequential consistency because it did the extra work of rechecking, do I still have this in my cache in the same state? So if you do that sort of work, and it also did the extra work of saying, I'm going to execute this load even though I don't know what the store before it is to. And later on, if that happened to conflict, it would fix that. So memory ordering is another example of speculation we've seen, assuming that a memory access won't conflict and fixing it later if it does. With branch prediction, assuming a branch will go to a first in place and fixing it later if it doesn't. So these are all cases where we don't actually know the result of something, but we guess what the dependency is going to do. And an area of research is adding more ways of doing speculation just because it lets us avoid this limitation. But this is a fundamental limitation, and this is very program dependent. You can write a program which has very few dependencies and is very friendly to an out-of-order processor. You can write a program which has lots of dependencies and isn't friendly. And you pretty much, you can't tell by just looking at what instructions are being executed, what category the program is in. So this is the biggest limitation. So there are some other limitations that you should be able to reason about. So one is that we have this bunch of data structures which keep track of instructions which are quote unquote in flight, that have been started but not committed. So for example, the physical registers are keeping track of something about instructions that are running. So changing the number of physical registers will change how many instructions we can have active. And active in the sense of having a value that we potentially need to keep around. The sizes of queues affect how many instructions we can have lying around. And this is important for dependencies because if we don't have an instruction in our queue that can use a result, we're not going to run it. Doesn't matter if 100 cycles later, there's no dependencies until then, and we could run that 100 instructions later. If it's not in our queue, we're not going to run it, start it. The size of the reorder buffer, like physical registers, limits how far we can look ahead. If we run out of space in our reorder buffer, we're not going to keep running things. We're not going to keep renaming instructions. We aren't going to start those instructions, even if they're ready to run. So if we're waiting on some long latency instruction in our reorder buffer, it doesn't matter that we don't need its result right away for anything else. If it makes us run out of reorder buffer entries, we're not going to keep going. And similarly, active cache misses, that's another resource which limits the number of instructions we can have in flight, even if the memory system can handle it. We need to track the instructions that depend on it. And sort of, there's a bunch of miscellaneous issues you can think of with reaching about out-of-order processor performance. So one thing that we dealt with a bit in homework two was, do we have the right types of functional units for the program? It's not just a matter of whether you have enough throughput for instructions overall, it's whether the type of operations you can do actually match what the programs want to do. Having a whole bunch of floating point multipliers is not going to help integer programs. And so, another sort of minor issue which might happen is that we have wasted work from things like not just branch misprediction would be an example, but from, if we have exceptions of some sort, even soft exceptions like the processor speculated something, you need to undo that speculation, like for memory ordering. Like it assumed a load would not conflict with an earlier store. And it ended up being wrong. Sometimes correcting for that, can be expensive. because the easiest way to correct, unless you keep other state, is to actually rewind the instructions that you already started and do them again. Okay, and we're almost done. So I have an exercise for this, but we probably don't have the time that people will really like us doing this. My next topic is talking about VLIW. Who would prefer I go over the answers to this versus VLIW? Who would prefer I go over VLIW versus answers to this? Okay, so we'll go on to VLIW. This is an exercise you can do for studying. If you know the answer to this question, you're probably pretty good. Answer to some of these sub-questions. So the idea in VLIW, so VLIW is this alternative to sort of out of order. The idea is we fetch a bundle of instructions, and we have these parallel pipelines, but shared registers. And these pipelines are specialized. So they have different kinds of operations they can do. And the thing that VLIW is going to gain over out of order is that we're going to push all the work of figuring out what to put in each pipeline and when to put the instructions there into the compiler. That we're not going to do any scheduling logic. We're just going to fetch the next instructions that we're told to fetch. Bundle of instructions. We'll have branches. We might do branch prediction, but we're just going to fetch the next bundle of instructions. We're not going to try to skip ahead in the instruction stream. The compiler, at compile time, is going to tell us what instructions to run together. And often, it's going to need to actually do dependency detection, that we're not even going to look for cases where you're reading from a register here and then trying to read from it in the next cycle. We're going to have the compiler deal with that. The compiler needs to know how long an instruction takes to write back when it's computing its instruction stream. And so this eliminates the scheduling logic, and it might even eliminate the reorder buffer because we're executing in order. And if you remember, VLIW had some reasons that it probably didn't take off as much as it could have. So one reason is it requires a smart compiler. So you can get really, really efficient code on a VLIW because you have lots of parallelism, you have all these parallel pipelines, and you don't have all this expensive control logic and the extra time and space that takes on the chip. But your compiler really needs to know what it's doing to take advantage of this. Another issue is that there's things that out-of-order processors do a lot of, which are very important today, like rescheduling instructions based on how long cache accesses actually take. This dynamic scheduling, where we look at what actually happened and change how we schedule instructions. And VLIW processors don't have scheduling logic. They can't do this. So unless the compiler can guess how long the cache access takes, you're not going to get that advantage. They also have this sort of portability problem, that we're used to writing x86 code, you know, which is mostly compatible with processors you could buy 15 years ago. But the VLIW design, since we want the compilers to actually schedule our instructions, doesn't have that flexibility. Now, if you look at Itanium tried to address this issue a bit. And this issue a bit, but you know, that's still, you know, so there's been efforts, but it didn't seem to actually get to something successful. But the idea is that, like vector processors eliminate all this extra logic by making instructions do more, VLIW processors eliminate extra logic by making compilers do more scheduling of instructions that the out-of-order processors would otherwise do. And I do not think we have enough time for this exercise, but it will be in the slides posted. So you can write an answer yourself. I guess I will point out some key features of solving problems like this, which is that we have this latency here. That's a common feature that real IW processors might have. They might say, the instruction will take up to 2 cycles to produce its result. Up to 2 instruction bundles later, you'll get the results. Which means that you might have to have deliberate no-ops. I guess I can go through this answer here. So the real exercise is the efficient version of this, since this is obviously inefficient. So here we load foo, load bar, increment I, increment foo, increment bar, do the multiply. We need to wait for the result because everything takes 2 cycles to produce a result, not 1. So we need to have these no-ops to wait for a result. And that's sort of a common thing with these VLIW processors is that they're going to say, this takes a few cycles. I'm not going to figure it out for you. You need to know that as a compiler or as an assembly writer. And then we do the store now that the value is ready to store. And I suppose I could put go do loop there, but I didn't. And to make this efficient, we need to do some extra steps. So the efficient version of this, which you can try to do as an exercise, is that you unroll this loop. And when you unroll this loop, you, knowing that things do not depend on each other, knowing that foo and bar are separate or testing for that, can fill these no-ops with actual useful work. And that's what the VLIW authors depend on the compiler being able to do, to be able to unroll loops like this and find things to fill all these no-op slots. So we could take advantage of those specialized pipelines. And the specialized pipelines gave us the flexibility to have, less space be used to do the same amount of computation in our processor. It would be pretty expensive here if we needed to deal with memory in every single pipeline. Then we have a cache which can deal with 3 reads and writes per cycle, which is probably not something we want to build. So some final notes before I finish up. So the final is probably more multiple choice than I suggested Monday, just because as I've written a final, more of the multiple choice questions survive because I was looking at how long things would take. We have the room until 7:15. I actually have that confirmed. My hope is that the final takes around 75 minutes to do, but I will give you 2 hours. And if you can't stay here that late, let me know and we will make some alternate arrangement. So also, I have office hours on Friday if you have some last minute questions, or you can ask in Piazza. And if you have super last minute questions, I have office hours on Monday in the afternoon, but probably should do your studying before then, given that I doubt it will help to be studying afterwards. Yeah, that's all I have. I'll be around. Answer questions briefly.